If the river keep rising, water gonna overflow.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tim Orr, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Glenn is a member of a men's group at Triangle that meets on a Saturday at 9 a.m. And when I first got sober, it was before I moved back to Gainesville, I would go to that meeting on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. That was a big deal for me. I had to burn up a little extra gas to get there, but it was always worthwhile, and I could hardly afford the gas at the time. But I would do that, and I would be in such a great mood and head back to Nava for the breakfast and do the Bridge Builders meeting at 11:30 and kind of knock that out. And that was my routine for a while. And Glenn's been around since 1990, so he was one of those guys that had the door open for me.
Thank you. My name is Glenn, and I'm an alcoholic.
First, I want to thank you for inviting me to share my experience, strength, and hope, and I hope that something that I say can somebody can relate to. I also want to apologize that I work in IT, and there's a problem going on, and I was trying to solve it. And I think I just realized what my problem is that from my laptop, using the bandwidth for this, I couldn't do the other thing. So hopefully I can get through this without being interrupted. Again, I'm Glenn. I'm an alcoholic. I was born in a small town in New York called Brooklyn. And I am the son of two people who were the beneficiaries of the civil rights movement, the people who were getting bit by dogs and had hoses sprayed on them. My parents benefited from that. And as a result, my mother was one of the first black policewomen in New York City, and my dad was a correction officer. And we lived a pretty ideal lifestyle until I was about 8 years old and my parents split up, and I moved with my mother, and we moved to Brooklyn. And we stayed in the project for a hot minute, and then she bought a building, and we integrated a strip of Flatbush, Brooklyn. And I stayed with my mom from 8 until 13, and at the age of 13, I started getting into mischief and trouble. Nothing really, really major. The main thing I would do is she would send me to go get a loaf of bread at 8 o'clock, and I would come home at midnight and stuff like that. And then her little belt whippings weren't good enough anymore, so she sent me to live with my dad. And when she sent me to live with my dad, I reconnected with some of the guys that I had known when I was 8. But now I was 13, but they said you came back at a great time because Butchie and Beverly are having a party on Saturday. And I was glad about that, and I met up with them. And when I met up with them, instead of walking to the party, though, they said something about getting some pluck. And we started walking in a different direction, and we walked to a liquor store. And outside the liquor store, they found somebody, and they sent him inside. And he came back with a bottle, and it was in a paper bag. And my buddy took the paper bag, and he squeezed it around the bottle. He turned the bottle upside down, and he hit it at the bottom like he was jarring some magical, mystical substance from it. And then they handed it to me, and I didn't know what Pluck was. I didn't think it was beer, but I wasn't sure if I was drinking whiskey or wine. Just turned it up, and I just look. And then someone stopped me, and then the bottle went around a few times, and then we proceeded to go to the party. And as we started walking to that party, my friends started talking about girls and their exploits, who they had kissed and who they had danced with and who they had done some other things with. I'm not going to say right now. And I was afraid because I had never done anything like that before. I had never slow danced or kissed a girl or any of that stuff. And as they started talking about their exploits, I started shrinking. And then we got closer and closer to the party. And when we got a few steps outside the party, all of a sudden something magical happened. That warmth that I had felt in my nostrils from drinking that wine, it permeated my body. And my body transformed into my favorite football player's body, Jim Brown. And all of a sudden my afro filled out like I was Jermaine Jackson in the Jackson 5. And when I walked into that party, I knew that I looked and I was as handsome as my hero Shaft. And when I walked down into that party, I knew that I was the coolest guy in that party. And not only did I know that I was the coolest guy in that party, I knew that everybody else knew. And to prove it, I walked up to the prettiest girl and I whispered something in her ear. God, I wish I knew what I whispered. But I whispered something in her ear, and she smiled, and we started dancing. And we danced to one record, two records, three records, four. And then they put on a slow record, and I asked her. I just kept dancing with her, and I had never slow danced before, but I looked at everybody else, and I got it, and we slow danced. And then after that, I told her I wanted to talk to her privately, and I brought her into the back of the basement where the party was and where the washer and the dryer was, and I brought her back there, and in the immortal words of the great Biggie Smalls, breaststroke, left stroke, tongue all down her throat, and next thing you know, I was kissing her. And when I walked out of that back room back into the party, I had my arm around her. Not only did I know that I was the man, but I was also in love. But I wasn't in love with Antoinette. I was in love with alcohol. And from that point on, I went to school. I went to the school in New York called Powell Memorial, and there was a guy who went to that school named Lew Alcindor. Some people know him as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I went to that school because he had led that school to three national championships, and I went there to break all of his records, and I didn't even make the team. And I started running track. And I ran track, and also one of the things that happened is there were parties throughout the year, and I didn't drink if there wasn't a party. We were athletes. We played chess. We played electric football, handball. I ran track. I only drank when we were having a party, and during the year we didn't have that many. But during the summer, there were a lot more parties, and basically the main thing that happened in school is that at some point in school, I'd like to tell you, it was October 24th, 1973 is when I crossed the imaginary line. I don't know when I crossed the imaginary line, but at a certain point, I went from drinking on the weekends to drinking at parties to drinking or doing something else every day. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I would get intoxicated every day. Excuse me for a second. And I still continued to run track, and I was actually became pretty good at the hurdles. I was a Manhattan hurdle champion. And then something happened. I went to school one day, and I was in gym, and it was all boys school. So the gym coach said, all you girls line up over here. We're having the president's physical fitness test. And I took the president's physical fitness test that day, and it consisted of push-ups and pull-ups and a standing broad jump, and I jumped a foot further than everybody else in the school. And he told my track coach about that, and the next weekend I was doing the long jump and the triple jump. And that weekend when I triple jumped, the first time I went out there and triple jumped, the competition saw me and they laughed at me, because the triple jump is something that it takes a little practice. You don't really get it after like 1 week. But I jumped again and they laughed at me again. And the third time I ran down the runway and I stumbled and I almost fell and I caught myself in the nick of time and I hit it, boom, boom, boom. And I remember the official said, oh, wow, somebody just got knocked out of the finals. And at that point, I was one of the best triple jumpers in the state of New York. And what that gave me, it gave me a reason to not drink and use on a daily basis. And the season was almost over, but we had some big meets. And some of the biggest meets were private schools championship, city championship, state championship, and East Coast championship. And especially when I got the private schools championship, I tried my best to not drink and use for that entire week. And I was able to not drink and use Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then when it came to city champs, I wasn't able to do it. I was able to not drink Thursday and Friday. And when it came to state champs, I just said, forget it. I went and hung out, and I went clubbing and drinking, and I left the club at maybe 6 o'clock in the morning, and I left there and went to Schenectady, New York, to state championship, and I won. I won. Actually, I set a world record that day. I set for the longest triple jump under the influence of alcohol, weed, dust, mescaline, and THC. And what I learned during that time was that, because the book talks about the difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic, and it says a hard drinker can stop when he has a sufficient reason. Well, I had a sufficient reason to stop. It was the state championship of New York, but I couldn't not drink. And I was 17 years old, and at 17 years old, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I had no idea about my life being unmanageable and the other steps, but I knew that I was powerless because I really, really wanted to stop. And eventually I got a scholarship to St. John's University, and the problem I had there was that I had never really developed good study habits, and as a result of that, I wound up losing that scholarship, and my dad was on me, and my mother had moved to California, and I moved to California to live with her. And when I got to California, basically what happened is I was in school. I went to Los Angeles City College, and I saw this guy. He looked rough and tough and mean, and I had a feeling he was from New York, and I found out he was from New York, his roommate was from New York, and the next thing I know, I'm in California, but I'm hanging out with the same kind of guys that I grew up with. And when I went to their house, they had a wall, and it was lined with Thunderbird bottles, and it was like, welcome home in California. And junior college was easy, and I wound up getting another scholarship at Cal State Long Beach, and there I think I fell in love, or I fell in like, and this lady was vegetarian, and she got me to stop eating meat, and also somehow, some way, I stopped drinking and using for about a 3-month stretch, and boom, I had the 6th longest jump in the United States, instantly invited to the national championships. And what happened though is before the national championships came, I was powerless, and I started drinking and using again, and I said I didn't want to go and get killed. So I didn't go to the championship, but they had the AAU championship, which was not just college, but everybody. And somehow I had stopped drinking and using, and I was in great shape, and I was ready to get down. And when I got there, I found out my coach didn't enter me in the meet. And basically, that was the end of my collegiate career and my Olympic dream. And from there, I took a test and I got a job with the city of L.A. as a warehouseman. And basically, what that did was it gave me the means to add different things to my alcoholism. I could afford those things that when I was in school, we could do them every now and then. Now I could do them a lot. And one of those things was cocaine. And then I got a promotion. I took a test and I got a promotion and I became an apprentice lineman and cable splicer. And what a lineman does is he climbs poles 30, 40, 50, 60 feet in the air, and he works on electricity, and he works on the hardware. And I was an apprentice, and usually apprentices do the most work. And by this time, also, I'm starting to do the cocaine quite a bit, and to the point where my nasal passages were messed up, and during the day, I'm working as this apprentice lineman. And I remember my first day on the job, my foreman said, "Son, this is the type of work that makes you either an alcoholic or a Christian." And too late. I already was an alcoholic. And but I didn't know it at that time. But now, looking back on it, I do. And what happened was every day after work, I was like, "God, I need a break. I need a break," because I was so, I was just so stressed up there on the pole with the electricity high in the air. Occasionally, I would look down, which isn't a good thing to do, and it's like, oh, man. I was so stressed. I mean, you couldn't have gotten a nail into my butt with a sledgehammer. It was just stress. And one day I said, "You know what? I need a real break. I need a real break." And I had heard about this free. And, so anyway, I said I would give it a try, but I needed some work done on my car. So I paid this guy to. I told my mechanic I needed some work to be done, and he sent a tow truck to my house after I had copped, and I tried it, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is what everybody's talking about." Then I hear boom, 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 boom. Somebody's knocking at my door, and it was him, and he wanted the keys and the registration and some other stuff. And I was like, "Man, just leave here. Here's $20. Just get out of here." And I stayed, and I got high for 2 weeks straight. I didn't go to work. I didn't go to work. I didn't call in for 2 weeks. And my boss must have known that wasn't like me, because the superintendent came and knocked on my door, and he came and visited me, and he asked me what was going on. And I told him the truth. And he said, "Well, really, you're supposed to lose your job, but now they're doing this thing called rehab. And if you decide to do that, you can save your job." So he told me to come to work the next day, but not to report to my crew, but come to the main office, and there would be someone from the EAP to talk to me. And that's what happened. And when I got there, they told me I was going to go to Kaiser Outpatient Clinic in Inglewood, California. And I had a friend who had graduated from there before, and I remember asking him about rehab, and he said, "It's like all the other rehabs. Rehab is where you make your best connections." That's what I remember him saying. And I got there, and they told me that I needed to stop doing all mind-altering substances, which I thought didn't make any sense, because I had been doing other things for years, and that didn't impact me. I just needed to stop doing the white stuff. And they told me I needed to go to meetings. So that first weekend, I didn't go to a meeting on Friday night or Saturday night. And Sunday night, I was like, "Man, I got to go to a meeting or else I'm going to get in trouble. If I get in trouble, I could lose my job." So I go to this meeting at this hospital. when I walk through that hospital, it's white and sanitary, and I see these signs of AA, and it's pointing, but there's nobody in the hall. And then when I get to the door, it says AA over the door. And I look at the door, and I'm wondering what it's going to be like, what the people are like in there. But now I look back, and I say, if someone had come out of nowhere and said, stop, before you go in that door, I'm going to give you an opportunity to make $100 million. And all you have to do for that $100 million is don't go in that door and promise me that you'll never go in any AA meeting, AA, NA, or CA. And if you do that, I'll give you this $100 million. And I would have took that $100 million and been off running. And now I know that would have been a horrible mistake. Fortunate for me, there wasn't anybody offering me this $100 million. So anyway, I open the door and I look in there. And it basically, it looks like I'm at the Lutheran church that I used to go to when I was in elementary school. And I sit down, and there's a guy talking, and he's very, very articulate. Obviously, he's very, very intelligent. And people are laughing hysterically. This stuff is kind of funny to me, but they're, like, really, really enjoying it. Like, they're almost at a Las Vegas show or something like that. And I enjoyed it. I left. When I went back to the program, they asked me, did I go to a meeting? And I told them, yes, I went to a meeting. I said, matter of fact, I went to a very, very important meeting. This meeting was so important that the president of AA was at this meeting. And my counselor said, the president of AA? And then he said, what? Did you go to that meeting at San Vicente Hospital on Sunday? I said, yes. He said, that wasn't the president of AA. That was Clancy. And that was my introduction to Clancy. And unfortunately, a lot of those other meetings, the speakers weren't as good as Clancy, but I continued to go to those meetings. And the next thing you know, I graduated from that program. It was a six-month program. I graduated from that program. And I started learning so many things. I learned that I had to change my playmates and my playground, because one day I was coming home and I saw this U-Haul truck with a Wisconsin plate. And I knew that I had helped a buddy of mine move from one place to another using that truck. But it was 8 months earlier and he still had the truck and he was parked in front of Reggie's house. Reggie, the one who said that rehabs are where he gets his best connections. And I knocked on the door, and when they opened the door, it was on and popping. And the next thing you know, I had relapsed. And a couple of days later, I relapsed again. And that's when I went and I came up with a plan. And that plan, I didn't call it this at the time, but now that I look back on it, it was the alcohol maintenance program. I just decided to do nothing but drink. Drink and drink and drink every day. That's what I did. And during that time, this guy at work saw me, and he was in the rooms, and he said, I want to take you to meetings. And eventually, next thing I know, he was sponsoring me. And one day, after he took me to a meeting, we went to his sponsor's house. And his sponsor was one of those good old school alcoholics. And he was like, hey, what's your name, kid? And I said, my name is Glenn. He said, yeah, welcome. And then I went to the bathroom. When I went to the bathroom, he was in his room, and he was scolding my sponsor. He was like, Mike, what are you doing? You're wasting your time with this kid. And Mike said, what are you talking about? The kid's not ready. Look at him. He still has a watch. He's not ready. And that's when I got my first AA resentment. And he would have really tripped out if he would have saw that it was a Rolex that I had on my wrist. And I had inherited it from my dad. My dad had passed, and part of my inheritance was his Rolex. But the fact of the matter is, he was right, because eventually I relapsed again, and I sold that Rolex. And I got in trouble at work again, but since I had passed that other program, they sent me into an inpatient program. And when I went to that inpatient program, I again graduated as the camper of the year. And after that, I went to a sober living. And at that sober living, they took us to meetings. And I went to my first marathon meeting. And at that meeting, I walked in, and it was a 6'3" guy. Well, he might have been 6 feet because he had on 3-inch heels and a dress. And he was getting some coffee. And I went and I sat down. And the guy, the leader of the marathon, came up. And he said, I want to welcome everybody to the San Pedro Labor Day Marathon. He said, the newcomers are the most important people in the meeting. And this particular meeting is designed to hear from new people. And we want to hear from people with 6 months or less. And he said, I want to welcome the newcomers. I want to welcome the men and women. And whatever the hell that thing is back there. Well, that 6'3" transvestite took off for the podium. And when he got there, they met, and bam, he punched him in the face. And the next thing you know, they're throwing down like Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler. And eventually people broke it up, and it was a big commotion. And somebody said, it's still a meeting, it's still a meeting. And I was about to learn something. And because of what went down, I went and shared. Normally, I would not share, but because I said anything goes here. So I said, I'm Glenn. I'm an alcoholic, and I've got 60 days, and I want to share. And they let me share, and I told them, I am sick and tired of white people. I work with white people. Now I live with white people. I turn on the TV, and I see white people, and now I have to go to meetings with white people. I am sick of white people. Thanks for letting me share. And I learned that the crying mouth gets fed, because this Mexican guy came up to me and he said, Holmes, I need to tell you about this place. It's called 9604. And I said, where is it? And he said, it's on 9604 Figueroa, and that's where your people are. And when I got a chance, I went there. And when I got to that place, I got there early and I sat down. God, I felt just as uncomfortable in that meeting as I did in the all-white meeting. And I got up and I went to the coffee pot. And there was a guy ahead of me getting coffee. And he had a nice haircut and he had a nice jacket. And he had on some expensive shoes. And he looked like the kind of guy that could pull the kind of woman that I wanted. And then when he finished getting his coffee, he turned around and he spoke to me. And I figured I had at that time maybe about 3 months. I figured he might have had 9 months or something like that. And then I went to sit down, and this guy, he was sharing, and he was sharing about doing the Thorazine shuffle. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then after that, he shared about being broke, busted, disgusted, and couldn't be trusted. And that, I knew what he was talking about. And I felt that because that was me. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Jungle Fever, but there was a character in that movie called Gator, and that was me. And I wasn't allowed in my parents' house. My mother used to give me stuff, and I would have to come to the back door. And she would feed me or give me money or whatever. And eventually, I got kicked out of that sober living that I was staying in. And during this period, I think this is when I felt like I hit my bottom, because I was living in my car and my diet consisted of French fries from Fatburger and Astro Burger. I would pull up there and I would watch people eat sitting outside. And when they finished, I would jump out of my car and grab their bag and bring it in my car. And that's what I would eat. And I also lived off AA cookies. And then there was this one Cocaine Anonymous meeting in Beverly Hills. Oh my God, they would have 4 pizzas every Sunday, and I was always at that meeting. And eventually my sponsor got me into another program. And at this program, they had a Bigwood study. People came from the outside, and they were reading the solution. And when the Bigwood study started, someone said, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. And when he said that, I said, that's me. Because one of the things they said is that if you want to change alcohol for whatever your drug of choice is, and I said, that's me, my most powerful desire to stop was of absolutely no avail. And then when I listened back to what they were talking about, they said, at certain times we're able to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We were without defense against that first drink. And that was me. And now I can see that 90% of the solution is understanding the problem. How are you going to get a solution if you don't understand the problem? Because I thought the problem was that I was a chump. I thought the problem was that my willpower was weak. I thought the problem was that I was a bad person. But what that chapter told me was that I was a sick person trying to get well. I wasn't a bad person trying to get good. And after that, a couple of days later, my roommate came into, because we shared and that we have two people per room. He came in and he had a flyer. And he said, oh, this is the bomb. And he threw it to me. And I looked at it and it said, Maxine Waters, Project Build. Learn how to fill out applications and we'll do mock interviews. And I was like, I'm insulted. I have a college degree. What is he talking about? Learn how to fill out an application. And then I looked at the bottom of it and it said, we're giving out free lunch. And I was like, oh, I'll be there. And I was there and I sat through that thing daydreaming for 4 days waiting for my lunch and my $10. And the last day I got, they had booths with people from all these major corporations. And I went to the Urban League Data Processing Center and they told me the good news is that this computer training, they're going to give you a 2-year course. And you do it in 4 months and it's free. They said the bad news is they're full and the next class I could get into would be in 5 months. But they said, go ahead, take the test. We'll put you on the list. I took the test. When I got back to the program, there was a note on my bed that said, come to the office. When I went to the office, they said, man, this must be your lucky day because the Urban League called and said they want you to start on Monday. But really why this is your lucky day is because that job you applied for, they called and they said, as a forklift driver, they want you to start on Monday. And I was like, oh God, I'm not sure what I should do. I called the Urban League and I said, maybe I could do both. But they said that I had to be fully invested in this because it was 2 years of training in 4 months and I couldn't do anything else. So I didn't know what to do. I called my sponsor and I asked him what I should do. And, he said, say a prayer. And actually, that was my second miracle. I said a prayer, and I asked God to tell me what to do. And the message came back to go to that Urban League Data Processing School. And that meant I was going to lose that car. I had a pimped out BMW and that car made me feel better than everybody else in rehab. And it made me feel better than everybody else when I went to meetings because I had this expensive car. Even though it was 3 months behind on my car note and they were looking for it, but I was in a neighborhood. I was in a bad, bad neighborhood. They would have never found me there. When I went to lunch, excuse me, not to lunch, I went to dinner. I walked past that car and I was like, damn. And I said, God, please tell me one more sign just so I know for sure. And God gave me another sign and it was time for me to go to that school and I was going to lose that car. And I graduated from this other program. And before I graduated from this program, I was talking to my sponsor. And I asked him what he thought about this thing about not getting a relationship for a year. And he said he didn't believe in it. It's not in the big book. He said, even though he understands what people mean by it. But he said, this is my suggestion to you. I suggest that you not get into a relationship until you do your fourth and fifth step. That way you'll be in touch or you'll you'll have an understanding of one of the two people in that relationship. And that was the incentive that I needed, because I went ahead and I finished that fourth step and I did that fifth step. We did it in the back of the clubhouse where I met him. And after I did that fifth step, I came into the meeting. I was by that famous pot, and this older lady said, "Hey, how you doing, handsome?" And I was like, "You're talking to me?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm talking to you." I said, "I'm doing okay. How are you?" And when she said, "How are you doing, handsome?" that shook me up, because I was still the guy in my mind who was living in his car. The guy who was stinky and nasty, the guy who was ashamed to even go to his mother's house, the guy who could take a shower and still take a shower for a half an hour and still stink. And when she said, "How are you doing, handsome?" it made me think of myself in a different way. And when I went back to my seat, there was a young lady, a beautiful woman, sitting in front of me. Later on, I would find out that that was her sponsee. But I didn't know that at the time, and after the meeting was over, that lady turned around, and I saw her, and I had seen her before, but she was more beautiful in person, and I said, "Hi, how are you doing? My name is Glenn, and there's something about you. I just want to get to know you, and what's your name?" And she gave me her name, and she gave me her number, and that was big, and I didn't realize it then, but that was the first time someone had a woman had really liked me for me, really in my life, maybe in the fourth or fifth grade. But as an adult, that was the first time that someone liked me without me, because I had this car, or I had these clothes, or this job, or I had this drug or substance, because I came to her with nothing but me. And the next thing you know, she was my girlfriend. I had done the fourth and fifth step, and I had this job with this major corporation. And, yeah, that's right. I didn't tell you, I graduated from that Urban League thing really fast, and they got me a job with a major corporation. And I'm rolling at 7 months. And the next thing you know, I celebrate a year. And a couple of months after that, all of a sudden, the obsession comes on me from nowhere. The obsession is back. And but I know what to do. I'm going to go to a meeting. So I go to an 8 a.m. meeting, talk to some people after the meeting. I go to a noon meeting. I go to a 3:30 meeting. I go to a meeting with my sponsor. No, I go to my sponsor's house. We talk for about 3 hours. At 11:30, he says, "Glenn, man, I got to get some rest." And I left his house, and I got loaded. And because I was at this new corporation, they went ahead and put me through treatment. And in treatment, I came to the conclusion that the last thing I did was I went to my sponsor's house, and my sponsor didn't save me. And maybe I might need a new sponsor. And they had these people that came from the outside. And one of those people was this guy, Canadian Mike. And I love to hear him share, because when he shared, he incorporated the whole 12 steps into his share. And listening to him, I knew that he had a strong grasp of the steps. And I knew he had taken people through the steps. And I knew that that was the guy that I needed to ask to sponsor me. And I decided that during the week, and I waited for him to come on Saturday, and he didn't come on Saturday. And I saw someone else, and I asked him, "Hey, do you have Canadian Mike's number? I need to give him a call." And he said, "Man, don't you know? Canadian Mike killed Rolaine, and then he blew his brains out on Wednesday." And I was like, "Oh, my God," because Rolaine was a friend of mine, and that hurt. And I'd like to tell you that I was hurt because Mike, Canadian Mike, killed himself. But no, why I was hurt is because I realized that my thinking was crazy, that I wanted the guy who was to the edge to sponsor me, the guy who killed himself. That's the guy who I wanted to sponsor me. So I called my sponsor and I told my sponsor, you know what? I said, my thinking is screwed up. And he said, you're just getting there, huh? He said, I want to ask you a question. What's the craziest thing you ever did? And I told him this story about smoking crack with prostitutes and hotels, and I couldn't find my hotel room. And he said, stop, stop, stop. The craziest thing that you ever did was after you got the job, the car, the girl, the apartment, after you celebrated a year, after you got 14 months, stone cold sober with no substances in your body, you made the decision to get loaded. That's the craziest thing you ever did. And one of the things I realized was that after I got all of that stuff, I didn't do it consciously, but I basically said, God, thanks for everything. I got it from here. And what I realized looking back on it was that it took me 7 months to get the car, the girl, the job, the place to stay. And it took exactly 7 months because I relapsed spiritually, then mentally, then physically. And that it took 7 months to work the steps forward, and it took 7 months to work the steps backward to a drink. And I told my sponsor, okay, let's get busy with the steps. And that's what we did. We got busy with the steps. And after that, the girl went on, and somewhere along the way, I found a woman and her boyfriend was gone, and we kind of bonded as friends. And the next thing you know, we bonded physically, and I went through the steps. And 8 months later, I did my first amends, and it was a tough amends because I had to make amends to a woman who I felt hurt me more than I hurt her. And I was following my sponsor's instructions. And after that amends, I went to hook up with my new girl, and I called her on Wednesday. She didn't answer. I left a message on her answering machine because it was in, I think, like 1989. Yeah. And she never called me back on Thursday or Friday. And I said, well, I'm going to go to a sober dance. And when I walk into that sober dance, she's sitting on her not her ex-boyfriend anymore. She's sitting on her boyfriend's lap. And she's laughing and smiling, and they're as happy as can be. I walked out of that meeting like Fred Sanford holding my heart. And I came home, and I sat on the sofa, feeling the pain, humiliation, frustration, being a chump again. And this boy said, I'm the one who loves you. They don't love you. I love you. I can take away the pain, frustration, and humiliation. Let's go do it. And that's what I did. And I went and did it. And I did it all night. And somehow I made it to work the next day. And when I got to work, I fell asleep. I took a nap at lunchtime in my car. When I woke up, everything was gone. And I didn't tell you that my father's estate had been settled. And normally people would have $25,000 in the bank, but I had 25,000 crack coupons. And basically for the next 3 days, I smoked and I smoked and I smoked. And the phone was ringing, and it didn't work. I couldn't get high anymore. It couldn't take away the pain and frustration. All it did was make my heart beat out of control. And then I bought stuff from all over the place because maybe I had some bad stuff. And I smoked and I smoked, and the phone kept ringing, and I kept hanging up on them. And then finally I picked up the phone. My heart is beating out of control. I'm trying to get high. I can't get high. And it's her, and she's crying, and she's saying, Glenn, you got to stop. You're going to kill yourself. Don't do it. I'm so sorry. You got to stop. And I hung up, and I kept doing it, and I couldn't get high. And I said, God, you wanted me to go to the meetings, and I went to meetings. You asked me to get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor. You asked me to work the steps, and I worked the steps to the best of my ability. And here I am with a hot pipe and a heart that's beating out of control, about to explode. And I didn't know what to do. That, I think, was my bottom. But not quiet because I had one last idea, and that was my first love. I went and got a gallon of wine, and I bought that gallon of wine, and I drank that wine, and it didn't do anything. And I went to sleep, and the next day I woke up, and I was like, God, I don't know what to do. And I called my sponsor, and God, I think I'm taking too long with the story. But I called my sponsor, and he told me, you need to go to meetings. I told him I'm not going back to my home group. I hold the record for the most white chips ever, and I'm not adding to it. And he said, "There doesn't say anything in the big book about taking white chips, but you got to go to the meetings." So I looked through the Los Angeles meeting directory, and I saw Alhambra, and then I saw Beverly Hills. And I said, that's it. I'm going to go incognito to Beverly Hills men's meeting. And when I went to that meeting, I sat in that meeting, and it was a bunch of white men in that meeting. And they were sharing, and then this guy shared, I can't remember his name now, but he was black. I heard his voice, and he said he was powerless over alcohol and his life was unmanageable. And he said the reason why he had to work all the steps was because his life was unmanageable. Not nine steps, all the steps. And God gave the message to me through him, because I don't think I would have heard the same words coming from any of the white guys, but I heard it from the black guy. And when I left there, I told my sponsor I needed to go through the steps again, and I knew that I had to make it through the steps all through by hook or by crook. And what happened was I left there, and we got involved with the steps, and I made it through the steps. And a year later, I went back to my homeroom, and I celebrated 1 year. And this guy came up to me, and he said, man, I don't know if you remember me, but we were in treatment together. And he said, I don't know what those people did to you, but whatever those people did to you, do it to me. And that was my first sponsee, and I left there. And I went, the next week was Mother's Day, and I went to my mother's church, and I had some yellow flowers. And I didn't tell her I was coming, and I sat beside her, and she lit up, and I gave her those flowers, and she was so happy. And after the church was over, she called everybody. She said, I want you to meet my son. I want you to meet my son. And she brought me in front of her friends, and this lady said, wow, we finally get to meet this boy that we've been praying for 5 years. For 5 years. And I started crying like a baby. And after that, I had my sponsee. Things went well. With about 4 years, I bought my first new car, and I drove to the South. I went to Houston, New Orleans, Atlanta, Shreveport, and I came back to L.A. And when I got back to L.A., I got a call from my coworker, and he said, Glenn, I got something to tell you. I need you to sit down. He said, IBM is laying us off. And this voice told me, it's time to move to Atlanta. And that's what I did. And I came to Atlanta. And when I got to Atlanta, I had visited before, and I was attracted to Atlanta because there were a lot of beautiful women, and real estate was cheap compared to L.A. And there were a lot of career opportunities, more career opportunities for me here. And that's what I got That's what I got caught up into for a while, until I met her. And with 8 years, I met her. And I brought her to L.A. and I told my mom, Mom, this is the one. And when I came back to Atlanta, my mother was planning a cruise that summer. And I was going to bring my girlfriend to the cruise, and I was going to propose on that cruise. And she must have sensed that, and she didn't want to be Mrs. Glenn Davis. And she broke it off with me before that cruise. She did that. I felt everything that I felt when I walked into that sober dance and I saw Jerry sitting on George's lap. I felt the pain, frustration, and humiliation all over again. And I think God gives us tests sometimes. And sometimes he keeps giving us that test over and over until we pass that test. And this time, it was easy because, like I said, and maybe I didn't say it, but from day one, really, God took away the ability for me to get high. And then that whole time I had been sober, I never had any urges or thoughts. It was gone. It was removed. But what I did when I felt that pain and frustration, I called my sponsor. And when I talked to my sponsor, he told me that you might not be experiencing her rejection. You're probably experiencing God's protection, and God has someone better for you. And I came home, and I made it through that. And we talked, and I made it through that, even though what he told me that night was not what I wanted to hear. But I made it through that, and I wound up joining this men's group, the Heavy Hitters, and that was an aid to me because I was able to talk about a lot of things about my frustrations with women. Anyway, at 10 years, I came home for Christmas, and I remember Christmas morning, I was there, and my mother was glowing. She was making breakfast, and my stepfather came and sat at the table. And I had made a formal amends to them when I had about 4 or 5 months. And my stepfather looked across from me, and he put a key on the table, and he slid it across to me. And I knew that I was doing what he had said. When I made that amends and I asked him, the last thing I was told to do was ask, what can I do to make things right? He said, keep on doing what you're doing. But he didn't say keep on doing what you're doing for 10 years. He just said, keep on doing what you're doing. And at 10 years, he slid that key to me. And I went back to my old group, and they were having a marathon meeting, and in the back, people were sitting around. And when I walked back there, I saw that guy, the first guy that asked me to sponsor him. And he was sitting down, and he was sitting next to somebody, and they had a book between them. And when I saw Alton, I cleared my throat, and he looked up, and he saw me, and he jumped up, and he hugged me. And he said, I want you to meet somebody. And he said, I want you to meet Jim. Jim, this is my sponsor, Glenn. He's the one who took me to the book. And I could see they had the book on how it works, and Alton was taking Jim through the steps. And when I came back to Atlanta, I went through a series of horrible relationships that didn't work out, to the point where I just said, God, I give up. I know you always wanted me to marry this spiritual giant of a woman whose buck-toothed, freckle-faced, knock-kneed, pigeon-toed, with a jacked-up haircut. And you know what, God? I'll do it. Because the way these relationships, the last two relationships I were in, they ended horribly. And but then I said, you know what? I need to do another sex relations inventory. So I did that. And I had to share that sex relations inventory with somebody, and my sponsor was still living in Los Angeles, and I didn't have time, so I shared it with somebody who was close. And really, with that sharing with another person, it was like notarizing it. It was notarizing it. And then 2 weeks later, I went to a party, and I walked in this party. I saw a lady. She was attractive. I had met her years before. I knew that she was a diva, and she was in a cluster of people. And when I got close, they would talk about R&B music. And then the conversation shifted to jazz. And that lady said, you know what? I have a 4x4 painting of Miles Davis. And I said, well, I have a 4x4 painting of John Coltrane's Love Supreme album. And then we started talking about jazz, and everybody else kind of drifted away. And we had a conversation for about an hour. And the next day, my best female friend said, somebody at that party really And the ironic thing was, I was pretty sure I knew who she was talking about. And I had her number in my phone because I had got her phone number for a friend of mine. I called her and we spoke for 4 hours. And I realized that I had completely misread her personality. And the short version is, her Miles and my Coltrane have been smiling at each other for the last 16 years. And shortly thereafter, we got married. And I got to dance with my mother at that wedding. And the next day, my wife was throwing up. And my mother-in-law said, hurry up and take her to the hospital. You got to take her to the hospital. And my mother asked me some questions, and I answered these intimate questions. And my mother said, no, she's pregnant. And my wife said, we're going to name the baby after you if it's a girl. And you could see my mother was happy. And I think at that point I had finally made the amends to my mother. I'd never seen her that happy before. He knew that her son was in love and he was married to a great woman and his wife was pregnant and that they were going to name the baby after her if it was a girl. And then a week later, my mother died. And then 3 months later, I was at the Heavy Hitters Retreat, and I was facilitating the grief workshop. And I realized that I didn't have anything to grieve. I missed my mother. But I was glad that my mother died before me because there was a point where it looked like I was going to be the one who died first. And I'm glad that my mother died happy. And actually, before she died of heart failure, there was a procedure that she could have done, and they said it had a 30% chance of success, and I was told that she told them she didn't even want to do it because she was at peace. And I got to cut this off, so anyway, I'll just say that I gotta tell you that about a year later, I fell out with my home group and I started a big book study at my house. And a couple of months ago, one of the guys called me and told me, and he thanked me because he had 13 years of sobriety. And another guy called me earlier in the year and he thanked me because he had 13 years of sobriety. And those are the things that make this whole thing worthwhile. But I'll end with this. My kids were about 5 or 6 years old, maybe 6 or 7. We were at my mother-in-law's house in West Virginia. And she said, have you taught those kids the Lord's Prayer? And I looked at my wife and she looked at me and we just felt like terrible parents. I was like, no, we haven't taught them the Lord's Prayer. And she said, there's no better time than the present. And she said, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And my kids' eyes lit up, and they started saying the Lord's Prayer with her. And I was like, wow. And I looked at my wife, and she looked at me, and we both smiled, and we sat back and held each other's hands, and we listened to my mother-in-law with that glow, saying the Lord's Prayer with her kids. And before I knew it, they were just about over. And she said, and they said, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. And when she stopped, they didn't, because they said, keep coming back. It works if you work it, but you gotta work it every day and night. And I say that to mean that everything that I have today is a result of my relationship with the people in these rooms, the process of recovery in these steps. This program saved my life. And I've been able to help a few people, but I'm still overpaid. And I'll stop. I'm glad that I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Great job, Glenn.
Glenn, that's a wing diddle of a story, my friend.
That's mom.
God, but that's how it goes. And I was talking to Greg earlier. It happened the way it was supposed to happen, but I left out the first miracle. It was the way I met my sponsor. But if I had put that in, I probably wouldn't have. I would have had to leave out. It's all good. Thanks for being here for me, and thanks for inviting me, because that one part that says at certain times we're unable to bring to our consciousness with sufficient force the pain, suffering, humiliation of being a week or a month ago. Well, my personal experience has been that at certain times I'm unable to bring into my consciousness all the miracles that I've experienced, because you guys promised me one miracle, and that was if I go through this process, it would remove the desire to drink and use, and I would be made whole. I would be restored. But I've experienced more miracles than that. And sometimes I forget those miracles, and I just turned 30, and asking me to speak, it caused me to really look back over my life, and I could see how many times God had me. God was guiding me and listening to me. And Patty, when I was at that grief workshop, that's where I met M. And I'm not going to get into the details, but he had something that he was grieving, and I could see that he was in a lot more pain than me, and I knew someone else who was there who took a friend to a party, and that friend was murdered at that party, and he was really grieving. And, oh, God, and I realized compared to that, I was blessed, and really blessed to be here and get a chance to tell my story, and thanks again. Hey, Michael, how you doing?
I was gonna try to jump in here, buddy. We've known each other, what, 22, 23, however long you've been in Atlanta. That's the first time I heard your story.
25.
I'm here today. Love you, man.
It's good to be anywhere.
Yeah.
When you mentioned Lou Alcindor, that got my attention.
Hey guys, we're gonna hand out the chips, and we got a special chip to give out tonight. And then if y'all want to hang out, we can chat some more. Glenn, that was awesome, man. We're so grateful for you. Okay, Kat is gonna give out the chips.
Hey y'all, I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. If you are coming in or coming back, we have a white chip. You have 30 days and 30 nights. We've got a silver chip. You just do 60 days, right? Does anybody need a 60-day chip? Here's your virtual 60-day chip. And then we have a 90-day chip. And we have a yellow chip for 6 months. And we have a green chip for 9 months. And then we have a blue chip for years or multiples thereof.
Hi, my name is Susan. I'm an alcoholic. And this is 2 years, and it's a miracle. I came in here 2 years ago. I was dying. I was literally dying. My liver shut down. I drugged and drank for 38 years, guys, and I was in and out of this program. My daughter learned the Lord's Prayer at Biscayne and at Napa, and she's now 35. And, I mean, I was in and out of the rooms, and I was just, I couldn't get it. I didn't think it would work for me. And I'm just going to tell you all now that this program does work. And I don't know how, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Kat and what she's done for me. And she, I just can't, I'm speechless. I can't even, but this day has been amazing. I never in a million years thought that this person could get 2 years without a drink in her body, and it is just a miracle. And so I can't wait to see what the next year holds. I can't believe I'm saying that. Thanks.
Thanks, Susan. I love you.
You can stay sober, Demick, by God. You can stay sober in a damn pandemic. There's no excuses.
Good work, Kat.
If the river keep a rising, water gonna overflow. If that river keep a rising, flood water gonna overflow. Just like that old river, baby, it's my time to go.